This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal land. Tonight, stories of exorcisms and abuse inside a faith-based rehabilitation centre funded in part by the taxpayer. Also, a new regime to protect staff from psychological hazards is on the way. Could it help end toxic work cultures?
I was crying and not feeling good enough to get out of bed.
Leaders don't need to be psychologists, but their job is to make sure that there are some support mechanisms in place. If they don't do that now, there are actually potential criminal actions that can be taken.
And a member of the royal household stood down after grilling a palace guest about where she comes from. Australians of diverse heritage hear it all the time.
If it's the first question you're asking someone, it's very insulting to that individual. Surely there are other things that we can talk about except for why I look the way that I do, because that's why you're asking me.
Thanks for your company. The government's first annual climate change statement has been delivered, and it reveals that Australia is not on track to meet the promised 43% emissions reduction by 2030 target. But we're not far off. The Climate Change Minister, Chris Bowen, says he's actually pleased with how much the government has achieved.
The previous government left their projected emissions reductions by 2030 at only 30%. The projections I'm releasing today show the actions and policies of this government so far have increased this projection to 40%. That is, we've lifted the outlook by a third in our first 6 months. Yeah. And policies we received a mandate for and are working to implement will lift our result to at least 43%.
That's Chris Bowen, the Climate Change Minister. Well, National Science, Technology and Environment reporter Michael Slezak joins me now. Michael, having made up considerable ground since the election, how likely do you think it is now that the government will be able to go even further or faster and still hit that 2030 target?
What these figures show is that they are very close, but they're not there. That said, look, they have only been in government 6 months. They haven't implemented all of the policies that are supposed to get us to 43%. So, for example, the safeguards mechanism, which is supposed to reduce emissions from industry, some of the electrical vehicle policies are not yet in place. You'd expect those should make up that last 3%, but we haven't seen it yet. That said, we also saw advice today released by the Independent Climate Change Authority, and they noted that Australia was not a low-carbon economy, and getting there will take significant transition, they said.
Yeah, indeed. So are there particular sectors where emissions are still on the rise and a reduction is going to be particularly difficult?
Yeah, so look, most of the government's effort so far has been on electricity, which makes up about a third of our emissions. So we've seen an enormous amount of effort going into that, a massive plan to build new transmission lines to allow them to reach 82% renewables by 2030. But we haven't yet seen in these projections, as I mentioned, a lot of the impact of policies they will be implementing or plan to be implementing around electric vehicles. So we haven't seen transport emissions reducing as much as they will or should, and industrial emissions, emissions from coal mines and so on, that should be covered by the safeguard mechanism. Now, that's a mechanism that puts in place a baseline, and that's supposed to lower over time to bring us towards our target and eventually net zero emissions.
So what's been the response from the opposition?
Ted O'Brien, the opposition spokesperson for climate and energy, gave a response. He did complain that to be fair, he did not have the statement ahead of time that Chris Bowen presented. He wanted to draw attention rather to the fact that energy prices are going up and wanted to tie that to the Labor Party's climate and energy policies. He also expressed concern about the thousands, he said, of solar panels and wind turbines that will need to be built to reach this 82% renewables target by 2030. And he defended the coalition's record in government, saying that they reduced emissions as well as growing the economy.
As the Coalition's time in office was concluding, Australia's annual carbon emissions had reduced by 77 million tonnes from when the Coalition was first elected in 2013, which means Australia's greenhouse gas emissions fell by over 20% on 2005 levels.
That's the opposition's Ted O'Brien. And Michael, what does the climate science say about the adequacy of this government's targets and how that factors into projected warming?
So look, Australia has committed to try to stop global warming from reaching 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels by the end of the century. That's a commitment we made under the Paris Agreement. To do our fair share of that, scientists have said we need to reduce emissions by about 74%. Below 2005 levels. Here's economist Nikki Hutley from the Climate Council speaking about that.
Look, they're absolutely not good enough. We need to meet world practice best standard, which is at least 50% by 2030. Given Australia's role in sending a lot of missions out into to the world, we probably should be aiming for 75%. We have the resources to do this. We have the wealth. We have the technology.
So, look, the overall message from the government here was that they have had 6 months so far and they've done a lot of the heavy lifting, but they're still not there. And they've been upfront about the fact they have more work to do to get to that target. Whether or not they'll be able to lift that target further and do what the scientists say is actually needed to reach the Paris Agreement, it's yet to be seen.
That's Michael Slezak, our National Science, Technology and Environment reporter. For 20 years, vulnerable women struggling with mental health issues and drug addiction sought help from a faith-based rehab centre in Perth. But instead of being treated by qualified specialists, they say they were given exorcisms and in some cases abused. The centre received government funding and some residents were referred there by government agencies. Well, now a parliamentary inquiry from WA has released a damning report into what happened at the Esther Foundation, including allegations of physical, emotional and sexual abuse. Isabel Masali reports.
Physical restraints, sexual assault, psychological abuse and extreme religious practices. These are just some of the allegations detailed in a report from a parliamentary inquiry looking into a Perth rehab centre that was meant to help those with addiction and mental health issues. The complaints span from 2004 to 2020. It's difficult to read, but none of it comes as a surprise to those who were there.
No, I lived it. Many of us lived it. I run a support group with over 300 people who have been victimised and their families, and none of this is a surprise. There's much worse than what's been said today that I've heard privately.
Gabrielle Osborne was at the Esther Foundation in 2014 at age 15.
I've had nightmares about those exorcism type things repeating and happening again, about kind of being held there. The worst part for me was really being taken from my family and held against my will, trying to run away, being brought back, being chased after by the foundation.
Another former resident, Lucy, was referred for an eating disorder. She's now been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder after her time at the centre.
It was hell. The exorcisms were the worst part. Just instilling such a deep fear into all of the girls, just to have that power over us. And, yeah, I just remember being terrified at all times about anything.
The Esther Foundation began operating in Perth in the mid-90s and grew out of the Pentecostal New Day Ministries. Over the years, the WA government has contributed funding, and in 2019, the federal government announced $4 million, with then-Prime Minister Scott Morrison visiting the centre. Earlier this year, it went into voluntary administration, and allegations from former residents have surfaced, triggering this inquiry. Committee Chair Chris Talentire says the evidence was disturbing, and the organisation fell into a regulatory gap.
What's become apparent through this inquiry is that we do have a category of residential care institution that doesn't fall within the regulatory framework that we currently have in Western Australia. And that's very serious because it means that people have no mechanism for making complaints, that there isn't the government oversight that can ensure the quality of care is provided to people who really need it.
The committee found faith-based practice formed the majority of the program and was a substitute for evidence-based treatment. It also heard complaints of LGBTQA+ suppression and conversion practices. In the wake of the report, the WA government has been swift to announce it'll move to ban conversion practices. The committee also made a range of other recommendations, including a regulatory scheme for private services.
It's kind of natural that a lot of these organisations do emerge from various religious organisations, from the churches. And those organisations can provide a quality service, but they have to be properly regulated. We can't have situations where people's individual interpretation of various faith ideas are allowed to dominate the treatment of people who have very serious medical conditions, serious mental health conditions.
The report said the foundation denies practicing exorcisms or conversion therapy, and said the religious requirements of the program were explained to participants. In a statement from earlier this year, the foundation said media coverage had caused significant reputational damage and had impacted its funding.
Isabel Massali reporting. Well, most of you would know you have a right to feel physically safe at work. Employers also have to ensure their staff are psychologically safe. And with the release of a new code of practice, managers are now obliged to identify psychological risks and protect workers from psychological hazards. Occupational psychologists say the measures will help address widespread workplace stress, and that could help lift productivity. Mary Lloyd reports.
Things did not get off to a good start for Laura when she began a new job in marketing a few years ago, and soon they got worse.
I remember a couple of days overall, the time I worked there, where I would wake up and just be too depressed to go to work, and I would call in sick, and I was literally crying and not feeling good enough to get out of bed.
The first thing that troubled her was that it took more than 2 weeks for her employer to set her up with a computer and give clear directions on what was expected of her. She now knows that was an early indication of poor work culture.
There was a lot of, you know, gossip going on, and the overall company culture was quite toxic.
Can you describe for me what happens in a toxic work culture?
You never feel like at ease when you're at the office. I guess you're always a bit on a state of alert. Later on, I realized I was not performing at my best. I was not giving my the best of me because I simply didn't care as much.
When things got really bad, she had to seek counselling for depression and anxiety and eventually left the company. According to Safe Work Australia's new code of practice for managing psychosocial hazards, her experience is unacceptable. Organisational psychologist Hayden Fricke says under the new code, employers are obliged to reduce psychological hazards in the workplace.
Leaders don't need to be psychologists, but they do need to be able to listen to their employees, understand what's going on for them at an individual level. And when they see that there is some issues going on, their job is to make sure that there are some support mechanisms in place. If they don't do that now, the change is that there are actually potential criminal actions that can be taken.
New South Wales and Western Australia have adopted the code, and in Queensland it comes into force in the new year. The Black Dog Institute says mentally unhealthy workplaces cost Australia up to $39 billion each year due to lost participation and lower productivity. Hayden Fricke says good leaders drive long-term productivity by taking care of their employees' well-being.
Yes, you can get high performance short-term without well-being or engagement, but if you want long-term sustainable performance, you have to drive a culture that's highly engaged and well psychologically.
Getting employees off to a good start is also an area where companies can do much better. According to a new report by research agency New Focus, 90% of newbies gave their onboarding a could do better rating, and 65% felt stressed by the experience.
Onboarding is a great place to start to set up your employees for success in terms of both performance and well-being. But unfortunately, the results of the survey show that it's actually not done well very often. So therefore, more people are feeling anxious and stressed, and their well-being is likely to be worse.
Some of the psychosocial risks people can face in the workplace include a poor relationship with their direct boss, unsuitable workload, lack of clarity over expectations, and having little say over the work being assigned. Organisational psychologist Dr. Kirsten Way says the new regulations clarify what's required of employers.
There's ways that workplaces can assess risk by measuring those things and then determining whether there's a, you know, real and not unduly speculative risk of harm from what people are doing at their workplace.
How serious is the issue of psychological harm in the workplace among Australian companies?
The amount of time that people are off work for a psychological claim is almost 5 times greater than it is for physical workplace injuries. So not only are people away for a long period of time, but it's also a lot more costly than physical claims.
The experts say all managers can be trained to look out for the well-being of their staff, but Laura has another idea.
If you make sure that in your company you have managers with a high emotional intelligence, then they will just naturally care about you.
That's Laura speaking with our reporter, Mary Lloyd. This is PM. I'm David Lipson, ahead Fleetwood Mac singer-songwriter Christine McVie, remembered after her death at the age of 79.
Funny, crazy English chick that knew how to have the best time, loved by everybody. She did not have an enemy in the world.
Well, as the parliamentary year draws to a close, the federal government has ticked off most of the major plans it took to the election. Labor have left themselves going into 2023 with a pretty clear slate. The question is, what will they do with it? Political reporter Claudia Long joins me now from Parliament House. Claudia, what are the major items for the government now that industrial relations and the Anti-Corruption Commission are a done deal?
Good afternoon, David. Well, going into the next year, the voice referendum is going to be a huge part of the government's plans for 2023. So it was a key commitment of Labor's to establish an Indigenous voice to Parliament that's going to be enshrined in the Constitution. It was actually the first thing you probably remember that Anthony Albanese mentioned when he was elected on election night in May. It's been a huge thing for Labor. We know this is coming in the second half of next year. And in fact, the rules around exactly how it's going to be held were introduced to the Parliament today. So the government wants to ban foreign governments, companies or individuals donating or campaigning for either side. They're also scrapping the 2,000-word pamphlet detailing the arguments of the yes and no campaigns that you might remember from the last referendum that we had in Australia, which was for a republic. So because we have the internet now, they're seeing it is less essential to have a physical pamphlet. So that referendum is going to be a huge part of what the government is talking about next year. It's a massive commitment for them coming in the second half of the year. Now, aside from that, obviously, inflation is predicted to keep on rising. We know that's something the government is looking at. The price of power, of groceries, of fuel is predicted to keep rising by the Treasury. So we've got the next federal budget coming up in May. That's definitely going to be a moment to look out for, because that's when the government has to make a decision about the Stage 3 tax cuts. Now, those tax cuts, as they currently stand, are going to cost the federal budget $254 billion over the coming decade. It is a huge amount of money and something that has been fairly controversial. It's something that Labor has held on to that was actually a former coalition government policy. So they're going to have to make a call on whether they keep those tax cuts by May, because as you've probably heard the Treasurer talking about, Jim Chalmers, there's also a pretty big government deficit that they're handling. So they're really going to have to balance these tax cuts with not having enough revenue, of needing to handle this the debt and deficit problem that they've got on their hands. So definitely keep an eye out for what the government is going to be doing with those Stage 3 tax cuts next May.
Yes, a huge deficit as far as the eye can see. So aside from the will they, won't they on Stage 3 tax cuts and the voice referendum, what else do we know about what's in the government's plans for 2023?
On the health side of things, the government has actually flagged this week that they're considering challenging big tobacco, essentially. You know, this is something that we saw the Rudd-Gillard government do too about a decade ago, I believe. It became one of their proudest achievements. You know, it was really something that they still talk up, members of that government implementing plain packaging. Now we've got the Health Minister, Mark Butler, saying he's also considering making some big changes to how cigarettes look and are sold in this country, potentially changing the colours to make them less appealing, putting warning messages on them. So that's something that he's going to be looking at in his portfolio. We mentioned Stage 3 tax cuts too before. The economy is going to be a massive part of what Labor is considering, because like we were just talking about, the issues with the debt and deficit, potentially issues around revenue. So obviously the government needs a certain amount of revenue to pay for the programs that they've promised they'll implement. We've heard from a number of economists saying currently things aren't adding up, the government is going to have to start making some pretty tough decisions. And also we can expect a bit of attention on the NBN, because before the election, Labor promised that 90% of Australians would be in something called the fixed line footprint of the NBN, which essentially is good service areas and speeds. And that's by 2025. So if they want to reach that, they're going to need to be making some changes next year to ensure that they meet that goal. And in terms of legislation as well, keep an eye out for gas and energy, because we know we're going to find out more about their plans for their intervention in the market next week. That's something that's going to be pretty major. And if there's a legislative side of that, so if they need legislation to bring that intervention into the gas market to fruition, that's going to be one of the first things they're going to be looking at tackling when Parliament returns next year on February 6th, David.
Claudia Long at Parliament House, thank you. At Buckingham Palace, a former personal assistant of Queen Elizabeth II has been forced to stand down from her new duties after she grilled a palace guest about where she comes from. UK-born Ngozi Fulani is of African descent and tweeted her anger about the exchange with Lady Susan Hussey. African-Australian women say it's a question they often have to deal with too, as Samantha Donovan reports.
Londoner Ngozi Fulani runs a support network for women and girls of African and Caribbean heritage who've suffered domestic or sexual abuse. She was at a Buckingham Palace function highlighting the problem of violence against women when she says she was questioned by Lady Susan Hussey, a longtime confidant of Queen Elizabeth, who just last week was given the new title of Lady of the Household. The BBC reports the conversation went like this.
Where are you from? Miss Fulani, sister space. No, where do you come from? We're based in Hackney. No, what part of Africa are you from? I don't know. They didn't leave any records. Lady Hussey went on. No, but what nationality are you? I am born here and am British. No, but where do you really come from? Where do your people come from? My people, lady. What is this? Lady Hussey, oh, I can see I'm going to have a challenge getting you to say where you're from. When did you first come here? Miss Fulani, lady, I am a British national. My parents came here in the 50s. Oh, I knew we'd get there in the end. You're Caribbean. No, lady, I am of African heritage, Caribbean descent, and British nationality.
Santhila Chingayipe is an African-Australian writer, filmmaker and historian. She wasn't surprised by the reported incident at Buckingham Palace and agrees many people in Australia fail to see the problem of asking someone, where are you from?
I know for a lot of people it's a very difficult thing to kind of comprehend, because they sort of go, well, how can that be racist? I'm just asking you where you're from. I would ask anyone that, where you're coming from, you know. But when you think about the context, and we're talking about environments which largely like to see themselves as monocultural, anyone that doesn't fit that narrative is sort of seen as another, as the other. Seems like a very innocent question, but it is very, very loaded, because it's essentially saying, you don't fit in here, so explain yourself, explain your otherness, explain your difference. And that is inherently racist.
Dr. Tinashe Dhoon is an associate professor in social psychology and the director of research at African Women Australia Incorporated. She says she and her patients regularly get asked, where are you from?
It makes me feel as though I'm being told to go back to where I came from, or you don't really belong here. And of course I do. My passport says so. When you give the answer of, you know, I'm from Adelaide or Melbourne or whatnot, people want to displace you and say, well, no, you're obviously not from here. So where are you really from? And I know a lot of African women, including my mother, who will return the question and say, well, you're a white person. Where are you from? And of course, the Anglo person is very shocked and upset about being asked that question. Well, I'm Australian, they say. Well, if you are not Indigenous, then you're not Australian. So it's when the question is turned around, then they feel the shock. But they seem to think it's okay to ask it of someone who is non-white.
What's your advice to white Australians who may, this question may go through their mind to ask this person? They might be genuinely interested in where the person has migrated from or where they're descended from. Is it a no-go area, or is there a way of approaching the subject?
There's definitely a way of approaching the subject in the context of an ongoing conversation. If it's the first question you're asking someone, it's very insulting to that individual of, surely there are other things that we can talk about except for why I look the way that I do, because that's why you're asking me. You're asking me because I have darker skin than you do, or my eyes aren't the same shape as yours. So if you're having a conversation about the weather, about this and that and the other thing, and you notice an accent that's different, or you are trying to engage in a wholesome, continuous conversation, that's a bit different than first question and wanting to kind of dig. And when somebody says, I'm from Australia, let it go.
That's Dr. Tinashe Doon, a social psychologist and member of African Women Australia Incorporated. Samantha Donovan reporting. In one of the most popular bands the world has ever known, she was a prolific force behind many of their greatest hits. Fleetwood Mac singer-songwriter Christine McVie has died at the age of 79. Little Lies, Don't Stop, Everywhere and Songbird, just a few of her creations. And today, she's being remembered as a brilliant musician and a cherished friend. Rachel Hayter looks back.
Born Christine Perfect in northwest England on July 12, 1943, McVie started making music while at art school. She rose to fame with blues band Chicken Shack.
Chicken Shack was supporting Fleetwood Mac on several concerts, and that was how I met Fleetwood Mac. I knew them all as friends. And then I became involved with John McVie. I was still in Chicken Shack at the time, and then we ended up getting married.
Christine then joined her husband, bassist John McVie, in Fleetwood Mac. They weren't the only couple in the famous five-piece. Another pair of lovers, Stevie Nicks and Lindsay Buckingham, joined Mick Fleetwood to form one of the world's most iconic musical groups. Fleetwood Mac's 1977 album, Rumours, sold more than 40 million copies and is one of the best-selling albums of all time. It was recorded as Christine and John were divorcing. You can go your own way.
Go your own way. Writing a song for the Rumours album and writing a song thereafter, did you have to sort of physically, mentally sit down and write the songs for those albums, or was it just something that evolved from this house, or where?
Just something that evolved, yeah, just came out of me, whatever, right. That, you know. I mean, without being heavy about it, I never like to get heavy about my music because I don't write heavy music, you know. Yeah, it's just something that I honestly feel.
Touring with Fleetwood Mac in the 1970s and 80s was Australian man Dennis Dunstan, the band's manager and close friend of Christine McVie. Dennis remembers Christine as a funny, crazy English chick who was loved by everybody.
Christine McVie and I became very close on the road because she was English, I was Australian. We liked a lot of the same things.
After Fleetwood's Tusk tour in the early 1980s, Christine invited Dennis to move into a spare room in what she described as her little house on the hill.
So I go up and I roll up to this house, and next minute I know I'm living in the west wing of a Beverly Hills mansion up on Lloydcrest Drive in Beverly Hills. And I ended up living there for the next 6 years. I was there while she was writing some of her biggest hits. And being a former drummer, I got to tap along to her, some of her demos, and she'd say, "Dee, I got this idea for a song. Come into the piano or the music room, you know." And I'd wander down there, and she said, "Oh, what do you think of this?" You know, and next minute I'd be hearing what was soon to be the song called Everywhere.
McVie left Fleetwood Mac after 28 years in 1998, but returned in 2014.
I just think that there's an inexplicable chemistry between the five of us, which will never go away because it just is what it is, you know. Until we're 90, it'll be there. No matter how far we go apart in our different spheres of music, when we get together, it's just something that sparks fly.
Christine McVie's family says she passed away peacefully in hospital after a short illness. Stevie Nicks describes Christine as her best friend in the whole world since the first day in 1975. Mick Fleetwood writes, part of his heart has flown away. Dennis Duncan says Christine will be deeply missed by the whole Fleetwood Mac family and fans around the world.
One last thing to finish up on, as Christine so beautifully wrote, don't stop thinking about tomorrow.
Great tunes. Rachel Hayter reporting there. That's PM. I'm David Lipson. Up next, The Money with Richard Aidey.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Integrity in politics has been in the spotlight, the former Prime Minister Scott Morrison being censured by the Parliament over his secret ministries. In the same week, a National Anti-Corruption Commission has passed. Today, Radio Breakfast host Patricia Karvelas on how the new body could go some way to restore confidence in our political system. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.